Good morning, everyone. It's Pastor Jeremiah here, and I want to welcome you to our online service this morning. Thank you for tuning in and joining us. So glad to have you with us. If you're viewing on YouTube or maybe you're watching this through our church online experience, welcome. So good to have you. As always, I want to make sure that you take the time to check out our website or maybe check out the church app. Look at all the different events and things that are coming up. We have a gingerbread making contest that's happening this Sunday at the church. And so if you catch that in time, it'd be great to see you there. Also, we have a Christmas Eve service planned on December 24th at 5 p.m., which is a great event to invite friends and family to. It's going to be a really great experience as we celebrate Christmas, the meaning of Christmas, with the lighting of candles and a recognition that God has sent his son Jesus into the world and has transformed the world through that process. There's something about lighting that candle and just that recognition that the light has shined in the darkness and the darkness has not overcome it. Such a meaningful moment as we prepare in our hearts for Christmas once again this year. And so I hope that you can make plans to join us for that. Well, we are in a sermon series, Christmas themed, of course. We're teaching on the theme of incarnation, on God taking on flesh, Jesus coming in human form to reveal who God is to us. And last week we took a look at that term Emmanuel, which means God with us, and talked about the implications of that. And this week I want to talk to you about God's glory being revealed through Jesus Christ, the glorious one, the one in whom all the glory of God was manifest. And he shows us, he reveals to us who God is. You know, one of the things that's so incredible to me is the period before Jesus arrives on the scene, before Jesus' birth, there was a 500-year period of silence where God was not speaking to his people, Israel. In fact, it's a miracle that their identity as a nation was even sustained through that time because the prophets were so, you know, integral to people understanding their identity. God would speak through the prophets. He would guide. He would correct, course correct. He would rebuke. He would teach and help them understand who he was and what their significance was in his plan. And yet, even in that 500 years of silence, their identity was kept intact, even though in a lot of ways they'd lost their way. Certainly they'd lost their way. And that was perhaps one of the reasons for that period of silence. But, you know, to wrap our minds around 500 years, I mean, our nation hasn't even been in existence for 250 years, even for half that time. And yet God's silence for 500 years. And it's an amazing thought that they went through that. And I think, again, their identity was hanging in the balance. They were waiting for the Messiah to come. And the Messiah was the one who they believed was going to be the king who would rule over them. Right? He was going to guide them and lead them in the way that God wanted them to go. He was their deliverance from bondage. You know, kind of like Moses delivered the people out of Egypt, God was going to send the Messiah to come and deliver them from their current occupation status, you know, Rome or whatever nation it was their turn to oppress them. Or a return to wealth and prosperity as a nation, like unto the days of King David or Solomon, where, you know, they experienced great success militarily. Their borders were expanding. There was wealth and prosperity in their nation. And that was what they believed that they needed God for, right? They needed God for all of those things. And this was, I think, maybe even you could say the purpose of God's existence. It's what they needed him for. Rule us, you know, tell us what the purpose of our lives is. Deliver us from all the consequences of our actions and give us wealth and prosperity so that we can enjoy the good life. And it's not too different from how I think you and I perceive God or God's role in our lives today. You know, if you could say that they were looking for a Messiah or a king to rule over them, I think that's kind of equal to us saying, well, God, what's your will for my life? Because really, if you want a king to rule over you, to lead you in the correct course of action, you know, many of us, we look to God, we say, God, show me your will for my life. You know, help me find meaning and fulfillment after pursuing that for which I was created for. Or maybe, you know, their hope for deliverance from bondage would be something akin to our idea of, God, clean up this mess that I've made in my life. You know, help recover the things that have gone wrong because, you know, I took a wrong turn here or there, or I'm facing the consequences of some actions that I have taken. Or maybe, you know, their desire for a return to wealth and prosperity can be equal to our bless me culture. You know, God bless me, give me wealth, give me prosperity, give me a job, whatever else it is that we are seeking. And, you know, it's not far off, their desire, from, I think, what is reflected in many of our desires today. But listen to the way that John, one of the apostles of Jesus, interpreted what he learned about God as a result of the actual coming of God, Jesus, in human form, to this earth. When the Messiah really came, what John experienced and what John had revealed to him was something totally different from all the expectations that the people had up until that point in time. John says this in John 1:14. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. John had received this epiphany his people had been waiting for 1,000 years. He had seen God in human form. They had been waiting for a Messiah, a deliverer like Moses or Joshua, or maybe like King David. But what they received was God himself. And not only was this not what they had anticipated, it was something that they would probably consider to be blasphemous, that God would come in human form. I mean, make sense in regards to their understanding of who God was, because the image of God was never supposed to be something to take on human form or form really at all. If you consider the commandment that God gave in Exodus chapter 20, verse 4, he says, "You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above or on earth beneath or in the waters below." You would think that that would include even a human being, except, of course, when you catch the rationale that we've been made in the image of God, you might get a clue of what implications that has for this particular revelation of God coming in human form. So why did God command the Israelites not to form an image of God's likeness? Why was that something that he forbid? Well, he didn't want their understanding of God to be distorted or to become distorted. For instance, while Moses was meeting with God atop Mount Sinai, as he was receiving from God the Ten Commandments, among other things, the Israelites thought that Moses had abandoned them, that God had abandoned them. And so they came together and they gathered all the gold from the community, from the camp. They melted it down and they created a golden calf, a god that they bowed down and worship, just like all the peoples in Mesopotamia, what they'd experienced back in Egypt. This is just, you know, what you did. This was the culture. And a golden calf, we could ask, well, why a golden calf? What's the significance of that? And of course, for people whose wealth was counted in livestock, you can imagine it was a symbol of wealth and prosperity. It wouldn't be unlike people in our culture today looking to the $100 bill, right? And oftentimes you'll see images of hip-hop stars or movie stars, you know, with $100 bills all over the place. And, you know, it's just a symbol of wealth, a symbol of prosperity, a symbol, I guess you could say, of success. In other words, what God was forbidding them to do, as he forbade them to make a form or image of God, and to do so especially, you know, in a way that another pagan nation would do around them. But in other words, God was saying, don't reduce me to a symbol of success or prosperity. You know, is that all that I am to you? I guess we could say. Ra, the sun god that the Egyptians worshiped, something that the children of Israel would have been very familiar with coming out of Egypt. He was the god of power, the most powerful of all deities, the god who would bring things into order. Well, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob refused to be reduced to being defined as just simply a source of power or a power amongst other powers in the world. In fact, When God is revealed in the scriptures, it is always in terms of the all-powerful God. He wasn't a power of many powers. He is the all-powerful God. But God didn't want to be reduced to a symbol of even power, right? That's not his ultimate meaning or purpose in our lives. As well, notice that God did not want to be confused with any of the representations of God that we find in the constellations. He said, nothing in the heavens above, nothing in the earth below. Many people used to and continue to use astrology to determine their future, their course of action. You know, we ask the question, what's God's will for my life? Well, many people look to the stars, right? Help us define what is going to happen in the future. Bring us meaning, bring us purpose through that source. And somehow believing, of course, that there's an energy out there that is conspiring for you. The universe is conspiring for you, or vice versa, the universe is conspiring against you. But God refused, again, to be reduced to a genie in the bottle who grants people's wishes, right? Or he refused really to be recognized as, you know, being the one who would grant the desires of, you know, a human being, as if a human being was the reason that the world turned around, right? Or that we were the center of the universe, or the center of the purpose of our world in any way, shape, or form. God refused to allow people to think of him in those kinds of terms. In fact, we recognize the opposite. In Colossians 1, verse 16, the Apostle Paul says, for in him, speaking of Jesus Christ, all things were created. Things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through him and for him. To sum up the meaning of what Paul is saying is essentially, you know, everything is created by God, for God. Everything is about him. Everything revolves around him. We live our lives, I think, oftentimes thinking that the universe revolves around us, right? That's certainly the way we think in our subjective minds, right? And so it's like, let me look to the stars and determine what my future is going to be, as if the universe was all directed at you or all about you. It's like, how selfish and ridiculous is that form of thinking? Right? And God refused to be reduced to some source of power that existed in the energy of the universe that was somehow present to bring us what it is that we desired, or to steer our lives in the way that we would want them to go. So let's go back to John's description of who Jesus was and what God revealed about himself through taking on human form. John says, the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us, and we have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. For John, the day he met Jesus, his world was turned upside down. He had seen the glory of the one and only God, something he never thought was possible, something he never could have imagined. He had an encounter with the glory of God. Now, John was a fisherman by trade, and so he worked in the family business alongside his brother, and in the family business, he had a role and he had a responsibility. I'm sure that he had dreams and ambitions of starting a family, getting married one day, building a family home. He probably had all sorts of ideas of the way his life was going to turn out. Plans, ambitions, all of those things. However, in one encounter with Jesus, he dropped everything, the scriptures say, and he followed him, he followed Jesus. Complete course correction, complete change of direction, new plans for his life as a result of meeting Jesus and hearing Jesus invite him to come and follow him. From that day forward, his entire life would be devoted to God's kingdom, sharing his faith in Jesus and growing the church, which is what John devoted his life to. We know from the descriptions of John in church history books that he engaged in that activity all the days of his life. In fact, he was one of the key leaders of the church at Ephesus. And near the end of his life, he was a very old man. He used to be brought in on a stretcher, one of the accounts say, And he would be brought into the church service on a stretcher because he was unable to walk, and he was feeble and old. And he would sit up on the stretcher, and he would tell people stories about Jesus. And I could just imagine being in the room and hearing a firsthand account from John, stories about Jesus and his interactions with him. I mean, I would have so many questions for John. You know, I would have silly, ridiculous questions. You know, like when you walked from village to village, you know, did Jesus ever, you know, sweat or get BO, right? I mean, did he ever have bad breath? Did he ever pass gas? These are like, how human was he, right? I mean, I would have all sorts of crazy questions for John about his experience with Jesus. But I recognize, you know, looking at John's story and recognize the interaction that he had with Jesus, how it radically transformed his life. Well, why? What was it? What was it about Jesus, right, that caused him just a 180, just completely flip his life around and follow him? And I would imagine that John's reaction to that, a response to that, is something like what he describes here in John 1:14. He said, well, I'd seen his glory. I'd seen the glory of God. I had an epiphany. I had a revelation of who God really is. And when you have an encounter with Jesus, everything else melts away. Everything that once had precedence and was a priority in your life fades away into the background as Jesus takes the first and the foremost, and pursuing Jesus becomes the priority of one's life. I had an experience like that when I was just 17 years old. And at 17, you have a lot of really silly ideas of how your life is going to turn out. And for me, it revolved around a professional sports career in, get this, beach volleyball. I was going to be a professional beach volleyball player. It was in the early 90s. Beach volleyball was becoming a very big sport. There was all sorts of sex appeal to it because it was on the beaches in California, and people were dressed scantily. You know, you're in shorts and no shirt, and you know, you're showing off your muscles, and it was a glamour sport, and I wanted to be a part of it. And I thought to myself, I could become a professional beach volleyball player. I would become an amazing athlete, a sex symbol. I would just have success and prosperity, and life would just be amazing. And so I dedicated my entire life to it. I would train my entire life at 17. I would train very hard, run stairs at the stadium, do all sorts of jump training and calisthenics, and practice every day, all day. The entire wall in my bedroom was covered with cutouts of volleyball magazine. You know, all of my heroes who were pinned up against the wall, and all sorts of scenes on the beach of you know, the surfing and the lifestyle of Southern California. That's what I wanted, right? I was born and raised in Anchorage, Alaska, and then lived in Seattle, Washington for a number of years. And I just wanted something different, right? I wanted to experience something glamorous, something amazing like that. And that's what my life was built around. I really thought that that was going to be it. My relationship with Jesus was virtually non-existent. I've been raised in a Christian home. I wasn't really interested in that at that moment. My mom begged me to go to this Christian camp. I went. I mean, experiencing this time of worship amongst a bunch of teenagers, a bunch of peers my age, as they're worshiping God in this beautiful setting at this camp, and the distance was this beautiful lake, and worshiping God, and had this experience. I had this experience where all I can say is I just recognized the reality of God in my life. I recognized how he had been with me through all the years of growing up, how he had spoken to me over the years, how I'd felt his presence in my life, and I was reminded of those moments in an instant. And God just really called me. He said, I want to be the source of your life. I want to be the one that you dream of and think about and focus on. I want to be the priority. I want to be the number one. And there was something in me, in my spirit, that moment in time. I experienced the glory of God, and I recognized this is all that I want. This is all that I need. So I went home, and I just told my parents, I was like, I'm going to move. I'm going to move to be in this Christian community. And they allowed me to go move in with my sisters so I could participate and be a part of this church community that I'd experienced this in and to really change my life, change all my friendships, radically alter my goals, ambitions, things I was thinking about for the future. And God grabbed a hold of me and turned my life around. And it had huge implications for my future and for what happened next, because I was following Jesus. And it was like being shot at a cannon. It was that moment in which the glory of God was revealed to me, and there was no way around it. I was going to pursue Jesus and let everything else fall into place after that. Now, at this point in a message like this, likely there's this sense of guilt that you might feel. You might think to yourself, well, I've never had an experience like that, where the glory of Jesus was revealed to me, or some crazy nonsense that you're talking about. Or maybe your response is something different. Maybe you're saying, well, I had an experience like that when I was 17, or whatever age it was too, but that was a long time ago, and there's a lot of water that has run under the bridge since then. Well, here's the good news. John elaborates and says, here's what Jesus reveals to us. Here's what the glory of God was revealed to be. He says, unlike what the Israelites perceived, that he was all law and order, you know, think Alice in Wonderland's Queen of Hearts, right? Off with their heads when they do something that God doesn't like. That's the way they perceived God to be. But John has this revelation of who Jesus is, and he recognizes something. He says he was full of grace and truth. Full of grace and truth. Let's tease that out a little bit. Let's start with grace, and we'll get to the truth piece. Jesus was a human being. He knows your weakness. He knows your temptations. He knows your tendencies as a human being because he lived his life as a human being. He knows the pressures that we face. He knows the anxieties that arise within us. He knows the scope of human emotion. He knows what it is that we go through. And it's not surprising that when you wake up most days, you wake up believing and thinking that the world revolves around you, right? We wake up thinking with this selfish mentality, right? Because it's ingrained within us. It's human to be selfish. It's human to think that the world revolves around us. That's not a shocker to Jesus. And so that's really good news, right? From the onset, we recognize that he understands that's the temptation that we all face. To think all of this that's going on in the world around me, that's all about me. Right? Every relationship, it's about me. Grace means that God is patient with us while we are trying to work out our salvation, and that patience is crucial for us to understand. He patiently walks with us as we stumble and fall, as we fall and then hopefully get back up. We are always encouraged to pick back up where we left off, to get up, dust ourselves off, and get back on the right track. And the difference between grace and this previous perception of who God is, right? God of law and order, God of off with their heads, is kind of the difference between, for me at least, and I'm a child of the 80s, right? I played this game called Super Mario Brothers. Anybody who grew up in my generation, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And of course, Mario Brothers still exists in the world today. So, but the original Mario Brothers had this glitch, and this was this cool little glitch that they had where you can get on, I think it was the second level, and the second level you had this opportunity to get endless lives, right? Or actually up to 99 lives. There's a limit, but it felt like endless lives because you couldn't even die 99 times before getting completely bored with the game. And so having 99 lives was like an endless source of life. And it was a difficult, tricky game to complete. And so if you had 99 lives, I mean, the pressure was off. If you had 3 lives, trying to get through all those worlds without dying. Talk about pressure, right? It felt impossible at times, right? So, but if you had 99 lives, it was like you could get through anything, right? The pressure was completely off. And that's my stupid little illustration of what it's like to experience the grace of God in an itty bitty form, right? It's just this patience, right? This sense that the pressure is off. We have endless lives. God has an endless amount of patience with us as we stumble and fall and try to figure out this thing called life and pursuing Jesus as we go. God doesn't have a whip in his hand or a gun to our head demanding obedience. But there's this patience. There's this willingness to work with us and to deal with our weaknesses. There's grace for us. And he's also full of truth, the other revelation that John gives. And the reality is that we all engage in activities that bring death into our lives, and we do so every single day. We're on a collision course with death every single day, but we continue on that road anyhow. Isn't it amazing how human it is to err? I know that selfish thinking and selfish actions wreak havoc on my relationships, and yet I choose to act and to think and to live selfishly anyhow. I know that laziness and procrastination will only produce pain in my life later on down the road, and yet I choose inaction anyways. I know that anger and resentment are like a rot in my soul, and yet I choose to stew on those things and to allow them to produce that death in me and to not let things go and to choose that path of anger anyways. And it's so human of me. But knowing that about us, God, he's the ultimate love and logic parent. This is another illustration I'll use. Love and logic, you may not know, is a parenting strategy. It's a parenting strategy that essentially works off of empathy and consequence, right? So as a parent, your response to your kid when something goes wrong or they do something wrong, it's like, oh, that's a real bummer, right? You express some form of empathy. Here's the consequences for your action. I'm going to love you anyways. So just for instance, let's say one of my kids didn't do their homework. I won't point out which one it was, but let's just say they've all been in this situation at one point or another. But you didn't do your homework. Well, bummer. You know, I guess that you're going to have to do your homework with dad every day after school for 2 hours before you play video games or whatever else it is you're going to do. Bummer, you know, you lost your freedom after school. You're going to have to be in homework camp. That's the consequence you're going to have to live with because your grades aren't where they're supposed to be. Or maybe you have a kid who left their lunch at home. They call frantically, hungrily, Mom, Dad, I left my lunch at home. Can you drive the lunch to the school? And your response as a parent, of course, would be, if you're following love and logic, bummer. You know, you're really going to be hungry this afternoon, aren't you? You're probably going to starve. That's really a bummer. Maybe next time you can, you know, remember to bring your lunch to school. And of course, the point is, and the idea is, as a parent, I'm not going to rescue you from all your problems. I'm not going to just erase away all the consequences that you're going to have to face in life as a result of your actions. I'm going to allow you to learn your lesson through experiencing those consequences. And I think that that's something like what John is describing as the truth factor of who Jesus is. You can make a choice, and truth is the result of that choice, right? It's just the reality, the consequences of that choice. And that's just life, right? You could choose life, or you could choose death. We all have had that freedom. That's one of the wonderful gifts that God has given us. We have freedom. You could choose life, you could choose death. And that is ultimately what we have to decide. I can either choose to pursue the one who gives life, or I could continue making choices that I know go against God's will, and I could suffer the consequences, which of course is death. But the beauty is that we always have the choice. This Christmas, Once again, I want to remind each and every one of us that God spanned heaven and earth to be with us as a human race, to reveal to us who he is. And as John said, and as many of us have experienced at some point in our lives, the glory of God is revealed in Jesus. And when we experience and when we see the revelation of his glory, I think what that is, it's this revelation of what life is like. Life in all of its fullness, life in all of its wonder, life in all the expectation that we have built up within us for what it should be and could be. That's the revelation of the glory of God that we have received. But of course, what so many of us experience through the course of life is that truth piece, right? The reality of the result of our actions, because so many times we have a dulling effect of the revelation of the glory of God, or we choose for some selfish, crazy reason, a course of action that doesn't lead to life, but that leads to death. And as a result of that, right, the experience that we have here on earth is not all that God designed or desires it to be. And God is patient. He's patient with us. He's willing to work through all of these growth challenges, all these issues that we have with being human and erring as human beings. That's his grace. And his grace is with us, and it will always be with us. But this Christmas, we have an opportunity to choose life as a result of experiencing the glory of God, the glory of his presence here with us in our lives. And my prayer for you, of course, is that you would have a revelation of who God is, that this would be a year that your eyes are open, that your mind is open to the possibilities of all that God is, and that you would recognize in such a real way the true glory of God and pursue that with every ounce of energy that you have within you. I'm gonna pray for you. Heavenly Father, we just thank you so much for these scriptures that bring so much life. Yeah, we thank you for the eyewitness testimony of a person like John who can reveal to us who you are, who you came to be. Yeah, we have an eyewitness testimony of just the significance of your coming into this world and a description of the difference that it made in his life and the opportunity for it to make all the difference in our lives. And so God, this Christmas, as we come into this season in which we describe it as the most wonderful time of the year, and of course, the reason for that is we recognize the coming of Jesus into this world. We recognize that the entire world is transformed as a result of that. God, we have an opportunity to live our lives in a way that reflects that. And so I pray that as we make those choices this season, God, that you would remind us of who you are, reveal yourself to us in numerous ways this year. Open our eyes. Open our ears, open our spirits to the glory and the goodness of God this season. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Amen. Well, I want to thank you for joining us this morning as we continue in our Advent teachings. And I want to continue to remind you to give generously to the work that God is doing through our church. You can give on the church website at westsidechurch.com/give. Also, you can give through the church app as well. Thank you so much for your generosity. And also remember those year-end gifts as we are in a year-end giving campaign seeking to raise $70,000 before the end of the year for our budget shortfall. I just want to ask that you prayerfully consider how you can give to help us out in that endeavor. All right, well, God bless everyone. I hope you have a really great next couple of weeks as we build up to Christmas. And I just pray that this message is an encouragement to you. So blessings. Have a great week. Hope to see you next time.